Before the Autumn Leaves Fall, a speech at the Guildhall on receiving the freedom of the City of London, June the 30th, 1943.
I am deeply grateful for the kindness with which I am treated, not only here, today, on this, to me, an outstanding occasion, but in the whole discharge of my responsibility. There is no doubt that this consideration shown to their leader by the British people, though far above his desert, is a very real and practical help in the conduct of the war. It gives me confidence to act and to dare, and that is a draft of life amid many toils and burdens. Of all the wars that we have ever waged in the long continuity of our history, there has never been one which more truly united the entire British nation and British race throughout the world than this present fearful struggle for the freedom and progress of mankind. Yes. Alone in history, the British people, taught by the lessons they had learned in the past, have found the means to attach to the motherland vast self-governing dominions upon whom there rests no obligation other than that of sentiment and tradition to plunge into war at the side of the motherland. Yeah. And none of these dominions, except Southern Ireland, which does not, under its present dispensation, fully accept dominion status, has ever failed to respond with all the vigor of democratic institutions to the trumpet calls of a supreme crisis. The overpowering influences and impulses that make Canadians, that make Australians, and we have here in Dr. Everett, a distinguished Australian, that make New Zealanders and South Africans send their manhood across the ocean to fight and die 3 years ago, all over the world, friend and foe alike. Everyone who had not the eye of faith might well have deemed our speedy ruin was at hand. Against the triumphant might of Hitler, with a greedy Italian at his tail, we stood alone, with resources so slender that one shudders to enumerate them even now. Then surely was the moment for the empire to break up, for each of these widely dispersed communities to seek safety on the winning side, for those who thought themselves oppressed to throw off their yoke and make better terms betimes with the all-conquering Nazi and fascist power. There was the time. But what happened? It was proved that the bonds which unite us, though supple as elastic, are stronger than the tensest steel. But now I must speak of the great republic of the United States, whose power arouses no fear, and whose preeminence excites no jealousy in British bosoms. Upon the fraternal association and intimate alignment of policy of the United States and the British Commonwealth and Empire depends more than on any other factor the immediate future of the world. If they walk, or if need be, march together in harmony and in accordance with the moral and political conceptions to which the English-speaking peoples have given birth and which are frequently referred to in the Atlantic Charter, all will be well. If they fall apart and wander astray from the commanding beacon lights of their destiny, there is no end or measure to the miseries and confusion which await modern civilization. It is fitting, my Lord Mayor, in a singular manner, to speak upon this theme of the fraternal association of Britain and the United States here amid the proud monuments and prouder ruins of the City of London. Because nothing ever made a warmer feeling between the British and American people than the unflinching resistance of London to the formidable, prolonged assault of the enemy. The phrase, "London can take it," and the proof of it that was given, stirred every generous heart in the United States. And their illustrious chief, watching the whole scene of the world with eyes of experience and conviction, sustained by the Congress of the United States, came to our aid with the famous Lease-Lend Act in a manner most serviceable to the great causes which were at stake.
The speech continued, "Of all our institutions, there is none which has served us better in the hour of need than our ancient monarchy." Around which all that we have is centered, and which at the present time is embodied by a king and queen most truly beloved and honored by all their subjects. We all welcome back home our gracious, gallant king from his visit to his victorious armies in Africa. And may I say, none rejoiced on his return with more fervor than his ministers who took the responsibility for advising him not to restrain his royal pleasure in respect of a journey of this peculiar character.
Later in this speech, he said,
3 years ago, Hitler boasted that he would rub out, that was the term, rub out the cities of Britain. And certainly, in the 9 months before he abandoned his attack, we suffered very heavy damage to our buildings, and grievous hindrance to our life and work, and more than 40,000 of our people were killed, and more than 120,000 were wounded. But now those who sowed the wind are reaping the whirlwind. In the first half of this year, which ends today, the Royal Air Force alone has cast upon Germany alone 35 times the tonnage of bombs, which in that same 6 months of this year has been discharged upon this island. Not only has the weight of our offensive bombing grown and its accuracy multiplied, but our measures of defense, tactical and scientific, have improved beyond all compare. During the summer, our main attack is upon that mainspring of German war industry, the Ruhr. But as the nights become longer, and as the United States Air Forces become more numerous, our strong arms will lengthen both by night and by day, and there is no industrial or military target in Germany that will not receive, as we deem necessary, the utmost application of exterminating force. The war industry of Germany is already to some extent dispersed in the numerous smaller towns. When the cities are disposed of, we shall follow it there. Presently, the weight of the Russian air attack, now mainly absorbed on their long active fighting front, will contribute an additional quota to the total blitz. This is, Lord Mayor, I can well believe, a somber prospect for the German people, and one which Dr. Goebbels is certainly justified in painting in the darkest hues. But when we remind ourselves of the frightful cruelties and tyrannies with which the German armies, their Gauleiters and subordinate tormentors, are now afflicting almost all Europe, when we read every week of the mass executions of Poles, Norwegians, Dutchmen, Belgians, Czechoslovakians, Frenchmen, Yugoslavs and Greeks, when we see these ancient and honored countries of whose deeds and traditions Europe is the heir, when we see them writhing under this hateful and merciless alien yoke, when we see their patriots striking back with every weak, a fiercer and more furious desperation, when we see all that, we may feel sure that we bear the sword of justice, and we are resolved to use that sword with the utmost severity, to the full and to the end. I cannot go farther today than to say that it is very probable there will be heavy fighting in the Mediterranean and elsewhere before the leaves of autumn fall. For the rest, we must leave the unhappy Italians and their German tempters and taskmasters to anxieties which will aggravate from week to week and from month to month. This, however, I will add before I sit down. We, the United Nations, demand from the Nazi, fascist, and Japanese tyrannies unconditional surrender. By this, we mean that their willpower to resist must be completely broken, and that they must yield themselves absolutely to our justice and mercy. It also means that we must take all those far-sighted measures which are necessary to prevent the world from being again convulsed, wrecked, and blackened by their calculated plots and ferocious aggression. It does not mean, and it never can mean, that we should stain our victorious arms by inhumanity or by mere lust of vengeance, or that we do not plan a world in which all branches of the human family may look forward to what the American Constitution finally calls life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
In a world broadcast from Quebec, August the 31st, 1943, Winston Churchill called for a three-power talk.
At the beginning of July, I began to feel the need for a new meeting with the President of the United States, and also for another conference of our joint staffs. We were all delighted when, by a happy inspiration, President Roosevelt suggested that Quebec should be the seat. And when the Governor General and the Government of Canada offered us their princely hospitality. Certainly, no more fitting and splendid setting could have been chosen for a meeting of those who guide the war policy of the two great Western democracies at this cardinal moment in the Second World War than we have here in the Plains of Abraham, in the Chateau Frontenac, and the ramparts of the Citadel of Quebec, from the midst of which I speak to you now. Here at the gateway of Canada, in mighty lands which have never known the totalitarian tyrannies of Hitler and Mussolini, the spirit of freedom has found a safe and abiding home. Here, that spirit is no wandering phantom. It is enshrined in parliamentary institutions based on universal suffrage and evolved through the centuries by the English-speaking peoples. It is inspired by the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence. It is guarded by resolute and vigilant millions, never so strong or so well-armed as today. I have also had the advantage of conferring with the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Mackenzie King, the experienced statesman who led the Dominion instantly and unitedly into the war, and of sitting on several occasions with his cabinet, and the British and Canadian staffs have been over the whole ground of the war together. The contribution which Canada has made to the combined effort of the British Commonwealth and Empire in these tremendous times has deeply touched the heart of the mother country and of all the other members of our widespread family of states and races. From the darkest days, the Canadian Army, growing stronger year by year, has played an indispensable part in guarding our British homeland from invasion. Now it is fighting with distinction in wider and in widening fields. The Empire Air Training Organization, which has been a wonderful success, has found its seat in Canada and has welcomed the flower of the manhood of Great Britain, of Australia, of New Zealand, to her spacious flying fields and to comradeship with her own gallant sons. All this, of course, was dictated by no law. It came from no treaty or formal obligation. It sprang in perfect freedom from sentiment and tradition and in a generous resolve to serve the future of mankind. I am glad to pay my tribute on behalf of Britain to the great Dominion and to pay it from Canadian soil. I only wish, indeed, that my other duties, which are exacting, allowed me to travel still farther afield and tell Australians, New Zealanders and South Africans to their face how we feel towards them for all they have done and are resolved to do. We have made a 20-year treaty of goodwill and mutual aid with Soviet Russia. You may be sure that we British are resolved to do our utmost to make that good with all our strength and national steadiness. It would not have been suitable for Russia to be represented at this Anglo-American conference, which, apart from dealing with the immediate operation of our intermingled and interwoven armed forces in the Mediterranean and elsewhere, was largely, if not mainly, concerned with heating and inflaming the war against Japan, with whom the Soviet government has a 5-year treaty of non-aggression. It would have been an embarrassing invitation for us to send. But nothing is nearer to the wishes of President Roosevelt and myself than to have a threefold meeting with Marshal Stalin. If that has not yet taken place, it is certainly not because we have not tried our best or have not been willing to lay aside every impediment and undertake further immense journeys for that purpose. It is because...
Winston Churchill's speech continued.
I have been asked several times since I crossed the Atlantic whether I think the Germans will give in this year or whether they will hold out to another, which will certainly be worse for them. There are those who take an over-sanguine view. Certainly we see all Europe writhing under Hitler's tyranny. What is now happening in Denmark is only another example. Certainly we see the Germans hated as no race has ever been hated in human history, or with such good reason.
We see them sprawled over a dozen once free and happy countries, with their talons making festering wounds, the scars of which will never be effaced. Nazi tyranny and Prussian militarism, those two loathsome dominations, may well foresee and dread their approaching doom. We cannot measure the full force of the blows which the Russian armies are striking and are going to strike. We cannot measure, though we know it is enormous, the havoc wrought in Germany by our bombing, nor the effects upon a population who have lived so long by making wars in the lands of others, and now for the first time for more than a century are having blasting and desolating war brought to their hearths and homes. We cannot yet measure what further results may attend the Anglo-American campaign in the Mediterranean, nor what depression the marked failure for the time being of the U-boat warfare on which German hopes were set, or the consequences of the shattering blows which are being struck may engender in the German mind. We pass here into the sphere of mass psychology, never more potent than in this modern age. Yet I consider that there are dangers in allowing our minds to dwell unduly upon the favorable circumstances which surround us and which are so vividly and punctually brought to our notice every day by press and broadcast. For myself, I regard all such speculations as to when the war will end at this moment as vain and unprofitable. We did not undertake this task because we had carefully counted the cost or measured exactly the duration. We took it on because duty and honor called us to it, and we are content to drive on at it until we have finished the job. If Almighty God in His mercy should lighten or shorten our labors and the torment of mankind, all His servants will be thankful. But the United Nations feel conscious, both as states and as hundreds of millions of individuals, of being called to a high duty, which they will unflinchingly and tirelessly discharge with whatever strength is granted to them, however long the ordeal may last. See how those who stray from the true path are deceived and punished. Look at this wretched Mussolini and his son-in-law and accomplice, Ciano, on whom the curse of Garibaldi has veritably fallen. I have heard that Ciano explaining one day why Mussolini had plunged a dagger into the back of falling France and dreamed himself already among the Caesars, said that such a chance would not occur again in 5,000 years. Certainly, in June 1940, the odds and the omens seemed very favorable to fascist ambition and greed. It is not given to the cleverest and the most calculating of mortals to know with certainty what is their interest. Yet it is given to quite a lot of simple folk to know every day what is their duty. That is the path along which the British Commonwealth and Empire, the Great Republic of the United States, the vast Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the indomitable and innumerable people of China, all the United Nations, that is the path along which we shall march till our work is done, and we may rest from our labors, and the whole world may turn with hope, with science, with good sense, and dear-bought experience from war to lasting peace.